Yes, we do have a quorum present. Therefore, we're able to continue the next budgets, and the orders we'll still continue this afternoon will be Hess, and then we move to the administration, and we'll conclude our today's meeting then with the education budget. There was something else I wanted to mention, and now I forgot, so.
We want to get out of here by 2 o'clock.
That's a good suggestion. If we could be done by 2 o'clock, that would be great. And I'll think of what I was supposed to say in a minute. And in the meantime, I'd like to recognize the chairman of the Hess Committee, Representative Boyer, and serving on that committee with Representative Boyer was Representative Skopinen, Ellis, Sponholz, and that position is now also filled by Representative Finkelstein and Representative Furness. So with that, Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you all should have in front of you a handout that we've prepared to go through some of the highlights of the subcommittee's recommendations at this particular point. If I can, what I'd like to do is maybe have just a general discussion of how we address the governor's FY89 budget, and specifically the increments to the 89 budget, and talk about some of the differences and why there is such growth in the overall budget. As is clear, or should be clear to everyone here, we have a growth of about $27 million in the Hess budget, and because the Hess budget is chiefly formula-driven, you have increased eligibles and increased access to many of the programs that are provided through the Department of Health and Social Services budget, and that, of course, drives the budget to the largest extent. But to start from the very beginning of the roughly $27 million worth of additional or growth in the budget, a little over $5 million of it has to do, and that is the area that we talk or speak of as adjustments, has to do with the annualization of positions that were funded in last year's budget, and also full year and second year funding of what has become known as the Healthy Baby Act. Of the $5 million in adjusted growth, $2.2 million of that growth is in the health benefit adjustments across the various components. $1.9 million of that growth, additional $1.9 million, is in full funding of the Medicaid option that we adopted last year under SB 348, and that was the Healthy Baby project. Last year, we funded that fiscal note at about $1.3 million, which is roughly half-year funding for that, with the expectation that this year it would be fully funded, and that's reflected here. And also, we picked up the second-year children's group under that provision. As you may recall, the bill provides for care from 0 to 5 through 5 years of age, and last year we funded 0 through 1, and this year in the adjustments we are also moving from 1 to 2, so we will be providing care for babies 0 through 2 years of age, and that again adds about $1.9 million in adjustments to the FY89 budget. The balance of the adjustments, roughly $867,000, are to annualize positions in the budget. Many of them, in fact, I'll just go through them. They were GICCHE related. That's the Governor's Interim Commission on Children and Youth recommendations, many of which positions we funded at 9 and 10 month levels. We have annualized those, and they range from social work positions to eligibility determination folks in public assistance area, medical assistance claims processing, and others. There's additionally a nursing position in there. Two of the positions deal with the mental health area. And again, last year we made a major effort toward meeting our commitment under the settlement that we have entered into with the mental health community. And finally, annualization of positions in youth services as they relate to detention and treatment facilities for youths in McLaughlin, Nome, and Bethel. But the collective adjustment to the base is roughly $5 million. We felt that those were areas that we could not get out from underneath, and the subcommittee's recommendation was to to accept the adjustments to the base. Additionally, one area that we set outside of our discussions initially was the whole issue of funding, continuing to fund our mental health program commitment. As some of you may recall, the legislature 3 years ago now, I suppose, began the consideration of a major settlement with the mental health community over what the nature and of the mental health program of the state of Alaska should be and what the funding source for that mental health program would be. And we set up an relatively artificial construct that set aside 5% of the what's the term of art? I just lost it. The unrestricted general fund revenues as a pool of dollars that would be available to fund first the mental health program in the state of Alaska as defined by the legislature, chiefly, or as determined by the legislature, and then other programs that the legislature saw fit. Well, this year in FY89, with the mid-case scenario, that fund approximates $90 million. And as you can see, we are appropriating from that trust fund about $46 million, I think the figure is, for mental health programs in the state. The balance will be available for appropriation as other general fund dollars for other programs in the state of Alaska. In FY90, it's estimated, if you use the mid-case scenario, that that number will exceed $100 million. And so we're well within, with this appropriation for mental health, we're well within the mental health trust capability. And more importantly, it was my feeling and the feeling of the subcommittee that we needed to move ahead and continue to meet some of the unmet needs of the mental health community, since we had the available funds in the trust to do that. And it was the subcommittee's feeling that the $5 million, roughly $5 million worth of increments to the Department of Health and Social Services budget was in fact a good faith, a continuation of our good faith effort to meet the needs of the mental health community in the state. That was not, however, the recommendation level of funding by the mental health community, the mental health board. Their recommendation was far in excess of the $5 million we've recommended for adoption here. We did, however, within that $5 million worth of increments, move things around. In fact, met here a few days ago with the executive director of the mental health board, with the governor, the executive director of the governor's council on the handicapped and gifted, and the Department of Health and Social Services, as well as the people representing the Alzheimer's group or senior groups, to try to come up with a reallocation, reprioritization within that $5 million worth of governor's request, so that we could reprioritize the needs of the core beneficiary groups of the Mental Health Trust. We did come up with an agreement, and that it should be, I think, the second or third page of the handout outlines the Mental Health Trust increments at the subcommittee recommended levels, and they do differ slightly with the original increment request by the department, but there is general agreement within the core group, mental health beneficiary group, as well as the department, that the subcommittee recommendations are a good reprioritization of the interest of the mental health community at this particular time. We, therefore, essentially took that money off the table for consideration for reductions, and so therefore you see the subcommittee recommending increments of $5.026 million. And I can answer specific questions about that in a minute if people have them. Representative Larson?
Sure. Thank you. The only thing that I would ask at this time, Representative Boyer, is that any funding that changed from general fund to general fund program receipt, you work closely with our office so we can adequately identify those in the budget.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to go ahead and go through some additional points, but I think Representative Hoffman had a question.
I just had one specific one, I guess. From the increments that the governor had suggested, there was some rearranging, and I guess from the feelings that I get in rural Alaska, alcohol and alcohol abuse seem to be the highest priority. And it seems to be a high priority in the state of Alaska as well. But from that direction, I think, at least in my district, that's one of the number one health problems that facing my region and rural Alaska in general. But from your figures, the two programs on alcohol abuse and soda administration, there was a reductions of over $150,000. Did the committee feel that The health problems as related to alcohol were not a priority, and that was the reason for the reduction?
No, Mr. Chairman, if I can, let me be very specific as to why we made some allocations. A Judge Green out of Fairbanks last year rendered a decision which defined more specifically the core group of beneficiaries under the Mental Health Trust, and one of the core beneficiary groups, and there are four of them, one of the core beneficiary groups is seniors suffering from senility, and that's not quite the right terms of art, but it's the SSMI group. That group of people fit well under the umbrella and was eligible for funding under the umbrella of the Mental Health Trust. And in the governor's proposed increments under the Mental Health Trust, that group of beneficiaries were not considered or were not taken care of, were not moved ahead in the overall budgeting process. So we were trying to maintain an even keel approach to treating all four beneficiary groups at least similarly, in as much as we were improving the services that were available to them. And so we had to make some allocations and carve out some dollars that would be available for that particular group. And as you see down near the bottom under the Department of Administration, OAC, we are proposing an RSA to the Department of Administration for this particular group of people. And when we made that adjustment and reallocation of priorities within the $5 million, we had to make other adjustments as well. So it isn't that we as a subcommittee felt that the public or the alcohol problems across the state aren't of high priority. It's just that we had to kind of manage all four core groups within the $5 million. It was my feeling that we could not come in with a number, an appropriation out of the Mental Health Trust that was larger than the governor's number. Clearly, we could have done that. It was my call not to do that at this particular time, but to live within the dollars available.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I guess with the with the articles that were in the Anchorage Daily News of the people in peril, there is a monumental problem out there, and it would seem that at least these recommendations from the governors would have received a lot more scrutiny and held up better in the process. And I guess that's just a feeling that I have, and I think that there is a major problem in that area. And although I have problems in where our budget is going, I think that generally that this is an area that needs additional attention.
Okay, further discussion at this time? What I'd like to do, I guess, is I'd like to recognize Representative Kopanen to get a motion before us, and then, of course, we will object so that we can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we incorporate the Health and Social Services Budget Subcommittee report, the number of $295,147.1 general fund for total funding for HSS of $473,000,000. 498.1 thousand into House Bill 100.
Okay, are there any objections?
Yes.
Hearing objections, please proceed, Representative Boyer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I can just briefly walk you through the reductions that the subcommittee did recommend. As you can see, we did, I think it's either page 2 or page 3 of your handout, we did make reductions of $7.2 million to the governor's proposed FY90 level. The majority part of that, a major part of that, was $5.187 million in pulled harmless dollars under the longevity bonus program. We felt that for the purposes of keeping people's attention focused properly on the overall cost or the real cost of the longevity bonus program, that the dollars that go to offset the reductions in federal funding with respect to recipients of various public assistance payments under the HESP budgets, that those hold harmless payments would be better reflected in the Department of Administration budget along with the rest of the longevity bonus program. So we've made a transfer there of $5.187.1 million to the Department of Administration. Again, that clearly is the largest part of the reductions we made. But just going from the top, we looked at reductions in the assistance payments, the Adult Public Assistance Payment Program and the AFDC program, and felt that, and it clearly was the caucus interest, that we not make reductions in those two public assistance payments that are needs-based programs, that we not make reductions to those programs that were any more than the reductions in the non-needs-based longevity bonus program, and that in any event, without statutory change calling for a rateable reduction in both of those programs, we could not reflect an actual reduction in the budget. And that's why you see zeros there. If HB 242 were to pass, and that's the proration bill that's been introduced by the Finance Committee, it would have to reflect in very specific language. It would have to reflect that a rateable reduction authority in those two programs, Adult Public Assistance and AFDC, before any reductions could take place. And in fact, if that language is not passed, the bill is not passed authorizing that, and we make reductions in these areas, the fund that effectively won't affect the programs. The programs will be fully funded, and the entitlements will be fully met without specific authority allowing for proration. So that's why you see zeros in those areas. Under medical assistance, in trying to keep the reductions in a way that they harmed the least amount of recipients of Medicaid, we eliminated, or proposing here to eliminate, the chiropractic option under the Medicaid optional programs, and that is the way Medicaid is set up. You begin from the kind of the top of the list, and you eliminate services when you have a reduction in dollars, and what we've eliminated is the entire chiropractic option here. That, in fact, all of the medical assistance eliminations have a corresponding general fund or a federal fund reduction as well, so the $275,000 there is matched equally with a reduction in federal receipts under the Medicaid program. The $1.134.5 million elimination eliminates the usual customary and prevailing payments increase to physicians chiefly. The Department of Health and Social Services a number of years ago, 1984, profiled a number of very specific procedures that doctors perform for Medicaid patients and set what is in effect a cap on the payment for those procedures for the doctors performing those procedures at the time. Since that time, additional folks, providers, doctors have come in, and if they're not providing one of those profiled procedures, they are paid at a different rate than the doctors who were profiled in 1984. So you have a disparity in payment for doctors providing similar kinds of services to Medicaid recipients around the state. The department has tried to bring that disparity into balance and effectively eliminate that disparity. We felt that in trying to make some reductions, we could not move forward with that at this particular point, so we have eliminated the usual customary and prevailing increases for doctors under that, under both the medical assistance under the Medicaid program and also the general relief medical program there. So if we end up with a total reduction in general funds of $1.503.7 million in those pass-through areas, and again they are matched with equal reductions in general in federal funds for that. Under public assistance, the postmortem program, the committee here has entertained a supplemental this year, I think, of $116,000 to supplement the funding necessary for the postmortem program. We felt that we clearly could also short fund that program with the understanding that we needed very specific intent language that said that if the dollar amount appropriated is insufficient to meet the need, as we have historically seen it's been insufficient, to meet the need, that the department can come in for a supplemental request. And I can speak more specifically to what happens if we don't fund or don't allow them that intent language a little bit later. Under Family Services, South Central Social Workers, the department under new positions has authorized a number of positions in the Anchorage area to meet what is a very critical understaffing of social workers that deal with child abuse and neglect cases in the South Central office, and they have recommended and we accepted the addition of 10 social work positions.
12.
10 in the Anchorage area.
Okay.
I think is what it was. 10 social workers in the Anchorage, excuse me?
I think it's 12.
It is a total. They're different levels, two different levels, but anyway, a total of 12 social workers in the Anchorage area, and then some social work or social service associates positions, six of those, and a couple of and several clerical positions to go along with those. Those were all phased, and they're all matched effectively with at least a 50-50 match with the federal with federal funds, rather than having those as they were in the proposal phased in over a 10-month period. We have recommended a reduction of $200,000 there, and phased them in over a different time period. So we found some savings in those positions. We also reduced travel by roughly 6%. We excluded the federal matching portions of positions, as well as the mental health trust portions of that. We further reduced by $92,900 funding for a surveyor position. This was a health, I think it's on under the medical assistance program. There were it was a health facilities surveyor position that effectively goes around and looks at long-term care facilities and deals with the problems of costs relative to all of our facilities, Medicaid facilities in the state. We felt that we made a reduction in that position. Under vital statistics, we reduced, and this was going into the department's base, we reduced their appropriation under vital statistics by $100,000 and asked them to go out and seek additional program receipts by increasing certificates by $5 a piece. And so we've given them a clear direction to go out and raise those fees. And again, that relate, we pull in another $100,000 worth of new program receipts there, and those were essentially the reductions that we made, totaling $2.078.9 million, exclusive of the ALB hold harmless. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer questions. If I can, I would imagine that given the size of this budget, that there might be some interest in talking about the new positions in more detail. There are a total, I think, of 87 new positions added throughout this budget, and I think it was my approach that sometimes you have to spend money to make money, and most of these positions are at least 50-50 matched with federal money. Some, in fact, a large number of them are totally funded by federal dollars, and some of them relate specifically to the Family Welfare Reform Act that that the Congress has passed. Not all of them, but I think there are less than half a dozen, in fact, three or four positions that are general fund funded. The rest of them are at least 50-50 or not, or if not, totally funded by federal donors. But I would be happy to answer questions if people have them.
Here, Chairman Hoffman?
Well, I guess just one comment. It seems to be popular to be balancing the state's budget on the backs of the dead since they don't vote. I guess I'm a little bit concerned about a comment that you made on public assistance for post-mortem exams and saying that traditionally that program has been short-funded and the legislature has picked the difference up in supplementals. Well, I guess I, for one, am not interested in getting from commissioners supplementals that they have full control over and expect us through the supplemental process to balance the their budgets. And I feel this way not only for HESP but for all of the departments. And I think that that's one message that at least this finance committee has taken in this last year. And if this comes up as a supplemental next year, I guess I would go on record as opposing that. The department should live within its means. Whatever obligations or responsibilities that the department may have, they should make sure that the budget that they request and that we fund, that they live within those bounds.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it'd be great if we're a living business, but it's a dying business, and unfortunately you can't very precisely. Yes, we have an estimate. We could fully fund it, and to fully fund their estimate would cost us another $116,600. And Mr. Chairman, I would certainly at some point speak in favor of an amendment to do that. And that's when in subcommittee, the approach I told the subcommittee I would take is to go ahead and talk about what short funding that means and support full funding of the program. rather than a supplemental. I think a supplemental isn't the honest way to do business around here, but it seemed that we were looking for reductions. This is clearly an area where, because it is an estimate of those people who may in fact die and need public assistance in that area, that we could short fund it, and with the expectation that we'd come in for a supplemental. But if we can guess, and the guess is that we need another $116,000 to fully fund it.
Well, I guess I'm going to support this budget, but it seems a little bit difficult for me to be adding some $26 million to the budget. And then we're still short funding a program for the dead. You know, it's kind of hard for me to understand that.
Okay, further discussion in relation to the Hess budget. Mr. Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a number of questions. Maybe I'll ask a few about someone else. But for starters, one of the things I think, you know, I've always been asking is on the Medicaid. Did the committee get a handle on these increases, which under the subcommittee recommendations are 19.8% for non-facility and 16.1% for facility? How much of that is increased eligibles, as the chairman stated, and how much of that is a price increase? Can you give me a rough idea of how much of that increase is attributable to those two factors?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's time to bring the commissioner and perhaps her assistant, director of admin, up. They could answer some of the more specific questions. But by and large, it's my understanding that the majority of that is driven by increased eligibles, increased utilization, as well as the COLA that is provided for under federal and state law for adult public assistance and AFDC. But perhaps they could answer in more detail.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman,
yes, Commissioner.
Myra Munson, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and with me is Frank Hickey, Director of our Division of Admin Services. Through the Chairman, Representative Rieger, with regard to the increase in the Medicaid budget, it was calculated on the following estimates. We calculate the increased eligibles based on our estimates of increased eligibles for our public assistance programs. For AFDC, we believe we're using an estimate of 3.3% caseload growth, and for adult public assistance, an estimate of 5.1%. We're estimating a cost of living increase, inflation factor basically, in the increased cost of 3.7% and a utilization increase of 3%. Using those estimates, we've calculated the increment request for the Medicaid budget.
Representative Rieger, please.
Okay, see, you have caseload and utilization in the two compound?
Yes, the reason that we have both estimates is that certain people who become eligible for public assistance use services at a higher rate and use more expensive services than others. What's happening in our total mix of adult or public assistance clients is that we're having the largest increase among the disabled and the elderly, who are much higher users of Medicaid services than AFDC recipients. In addition, we have increased reliance on the public assistance programs purely for the purposes of becoming Medicaid eligible. For instance, in the healthy baby option, people are coming onto the program only because they have a health care need which they're not able to meet otherwise. For instance, the pregnant women and their very young children. All of those things add to the increased utilization separate from the increased caseload count.
If I can continue, the numbers you gave me were for AFDC and general relief, or adult public assistance, I'm sorry. Are those the same numbers for Medicaid?
Yes, they are. We use because Medicaid is driven by the number of clients, in part, it's driven by cost, utilization, benefits, and the number of eligibles. So we begin our estimate for the future year budget by looking at the number of eligibles we anticipate receiving a cash assistance for aid to families with dependent children or through adult public assistance, age to blind, disabled, and elderly. And then we add in the other three factors.
But what? You know, let's just take AFDC, for example. Last year, the FY89 authorized $63.2 million. and this year it's 67,000,003, which I haven't run the number, but it sounds like that equates to 3.3 caseload plus 3.7 utilization and 3% inflation, or whatever those numbers were. But looking at Medicaid, for example, Medicaid non-facility, the increase is from 38,000,001 to 45,000,007, which is probably double the rate of increase. So something different is happening in Medicaid. It can't be the same assumptions, or you wouldn't have had that big of an increase.
There are four factors in the Medicaid budget. The fourth factor is benefits, and there was an additional benefit added in the or group. Actually, in this case, it was a group of eligibles added of women who are pregnant and their young children. Those people are not eligible for any cash assistance, so they are not AFDC eligible, but they are eligible for Medicaid coverage under Healthy Baby. That accounts for some of that difference, as well as, again, one of the things that we believe is happening in our overall system is an increased people coming in to seek public assistance in order to take advantage of the Medicaid program, because their greatest need really is for the health care coverage.
Another question, I might have missed it when the chairman explained it, but the governor's recommendation for Medicaid facilities was not cut, but the governor's recommendation for Medicaid non-facilities was cut. Could you go through the logic? I mean, those seem backwards to me, because the one that seems to have the most problems is the facilities.
Mr. Chairman, the first part is that it's hard, if not almost impossible, to get to the facilities while you have non-facility options available, and that's because the way the Medicaid program is provided for, it has certain required or mandated services, and those are all Medicaid facilities. That are Medicaid facilities specific. So when you make a reduction in the Medicaid program, you have to first start with the optional programs, which are, well, not all, but first 11, 12 options that we have are non-facilities, and you would have to eliminate all of the funding for all those programs first before you could effectively get to inpatient psychiatric, for instance, or intermediate care for the mentally retarded, or any of the institutional facility-driven costs. And it's not that it's backwards, it's the way the Medicaid program is established, that you have to meet those facility needs first, and then your options, as we have in the state, are the ones that you would have to reduce first. I think that's a fair characterization.
Yes.
Commissioner?
It is a fair characterization of the problem. I think I could elaborate a little in that. The other side of that is the facility costs are very difficult to get at. This year, after considerable effort on the part of the department working with then the Independent Rate Commission, last year we imposed some limit on the growth in the facility costs. We have two facilities, long-term care facilities, freestanding, one in Juneau and one in Fairbanks, threatening to go out of business because of the lack of adequate reimbursement. The facilities, the long-term care facilities in Alaska are virtually wholly reliant on Medicaid as a funding source. Following the federal rules, it's a tight funding source, even with the very high rates that are paid in Alaska compared to other states. It's a tight funding source. And it's very difficult to lower the cost or the amount we pay in those facilities. They are very much driven, they're very small facilities, and when their volume is not high, is not at the capacity, and it is not throughout the system, then the costs tend to be spread, they're spread over a smaller number of patients, and the cost per patient goes up, the rate goes up, and we see that reflected in the budget.
I know we've discussed this, but at some point I think something is going to have to be addressed there, because as I understand it, you can correct me. The problem is that regardless of the utilization, we as a state are going to set our rates to prop up every facility everywhere. And I don't want to overgeneralize, but that's the impression I get. Even if there's only one person in that facility, we aren't going to let a facility close. And, you know, maybe at some point that has to be addressed and figure out what makes economic sense.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rieger, I think that your characterization overstates it slightly, but perhaps not very much, in that I take it as one of my obligations to ensure that there's access to care throughout the state. Many of the facilities in the state, particularly the long-term care facilities, but also our hospitals, were built with legislative grants. I take that as a recognition by the legislature of the need for there to be health care, institutionally based health care in those areas, and it's my obligation to not only manage the budget efficiently and economically, and I'm working with facilities to try to achieve that, but also to ensure that there is continued access and that those institutions don't go under. So there is a tension, and I think at some point if the legislature chooses a different course, it really will need to say so. In the meantime, I look at having to balance the budget in order to have the cost go up as little as possible while retaining access to patients throughout the state to have that health care in their local area.
Mr. Chairman, I would just add, too, that with specific reference to the Fairbanks long-term care facility, Denali Center, we are not, even with the great accommodations made by the Department of Health and Social Services, still not meeting their daily charge under the Medicaid program. And what I've done is gone back to the community and suggested that, one, we have a community hospital that manages the long-term care facility, and as much it is a community long-term care facility, and we need as a community to make a decision of whether or not we think long-term care in Fairbanks for our residents is an important thing. And if it's not, you make a decision to close that down, because we're not going to be able to meet the total need by the Medicaid budget. And what that means to our community is that we have to cough up some money. We've got to either have a very specified or specific tax, or we have used block grant monies, or we have to come up with some way to fund the shortfall and the difference. And we're struggling with that as a community in Fairbanks, and it's not an awful lot of money, but it's about a penny increase, about a 1% increase in our alcohol tax would just about cover that. And taxes in Fairbanks are anything but a casual subject these days. But anyway, we're trying to take some of those things on ourselves, but it is a problem around the state, and I think all of us have to at some point say, and you know, that we can't meet all the need, and the communities across the state have to begin to meet some of that need as well, as I'm trying to suggest to my community and other communities.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try not to take too much time, but one of the points I make is that I've looked at the rates of reimbursement, and I don't think that the Denali Center would be the one I would focus on first. They're a low-cost facility. Right. I think it's elsewhere that maybe there's some problem. Going to the alcohol and drug abuse area, I received a letter just a few days ago saying that there is some kind of catch in Kessel's code, administrative regulations, which prevents nonprofits around the state which are performing state functions on behalf of the state, practically, from receiving the same kind of dividend assignment as the state agencies. And I was wondering if the agency would welcome intent language would permit them to override that so that the nonprofits would be on the same standing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Breaker, the regulation is actually a Department of Revenue regulation having to do with the permanent fund dividend program limiting assignments to governmental entities, including municipal governments. We became aware of this problem and have already worked through the accounting system to be able to have the nonprofits who are carrying out these grant functions get an assignment, transmit it through Department of Revenue. The assignment will be to the State Office on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, which will simply, or through the department, will simply transmit the money back to the program. So they will not have any diminution in their access to the permanent fund dividends assignments.
So you are going to fix it.
We've
without
already taken care of it.
Okay. I'll pass.
Okay, further discussion. Representative Copeland.
Well, they're all the minor ones. Norton Sound Health Corporation has a grant for sanitation for $106,000. Sanitation is very much needed in the bush, but isn't that the sort of grant that could be gotten to DEC?
The historical, Mr. Chairman, Representative Copeland, the BRUs, designated BRUs, have come about historically at the time that one was created. That DEC function, which in fact more properly is a DEC function, was put into our BRU so that all of those things could be consolidated for the ease of the program there in applying for the funding and in doing all the accounting. They work closely with the Department of Environmental Conservation. It does not shift who supervises or is responsible programmatically We simply manage the money and transmit it.
The maternal and child health program in Anchorage, which was, does that include statewide services in that area?
Are you, perhaps you can tell
principally me. Federal money, and it's under maternal and child health. It's almost entirely federal money.
Page number?
Okay, page is 165.
164,
165, 165, A and B.
Representative Copeland, it's my understanding, yes, those are, that's our, where our office is for the maternal child health program. Those are the, that's the central point for our statewide services.
Is the travel component adequate? I noticed some other programs that seem to be more local that have a large travel component.
Staff hasn't indicated they need more travel money, so I assume it's adequate.
Well, I'm thinking of, you know, whether the services are adequately getting out to the rural areas.
Actually, the service delivery system is not focused, is not primarily out of Anchorage. It's arranged out of Anchorage. They do a variety of strategies, including using local clinics in rural areas. The public health nurses of many different strategies are used to provide those services. I have not had it reported to me that there is any significant problem. There's always an interest in expanding all of those services in the rural areas and in the urban areas.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to direct your attention to page 3 of the short form and page 203 of the long form. My question is why is Fairbanks Community Mental Health Center money pulled out and set aside when I believe that it was funded in the governor's budget through the Division of Mental Health? That's the first question.
Mr. Chairman, what we've done is we've rolled that in, as the governor's budget had indicated, we've rolled that into the community mental health grants line. It's not any longer segregated out. The first 2 years of the program, it was, in fact, segregated out, and now it's been rolled under community mental health grants.
Where do I find it?
Well, as you can see, the 90 adjusted base for the Fairbanks on page 202 reflects zero. See, we've moved that the grant, as well as the contractual, all to the community mental health grant line, and it should just be a couple pages prior to that. I think it's page, you'd see it reflected on page 200. The increase in the grants line there should approximate the difference in the Fairbanks community mental health grant line, the reductions there. The theory there was that when we initially appropriated that money for the Fairbanks project, it was a pilot kind of a project, and now it is near maturity and needs more properly to be rolled under the base for community mental health grants programs. And I concurred in that in the fall when the discussions were taking place by the mental health board and the department at that time that was more appropriate that it be folded under the mental health grants line.
My second question deals with the Anchorage Social Services Office in one way, Family and Youth Services. And the other way, it deals with administration. Commissioner, I would like to know specifically why training for social service workers was moved from Anchorage to Fairbanks when specifically the line share the social workers are in Anchorage.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative. All training was coordinated, what limited training was available for limited budget was coordinated out of Juneau. When in last year's budget, in the FY89 budget, we were again given an increment to go for statewide training. Fundamentally, we looked around the state where we had the staff most well suited to coordinate the training, where we had an office where we had the least turnover in senior staff, and centered the training program there. The training itself will be organized regionally. We will not be replicating the statewide training center model, which was in existence in the early 80s. where most training or a significant amount of the training was done on by people coming into a central point. In the model of training that we're establishing now, most training will be done in the region where the staff is located. It'll be regionally based, heavily regional participation in design. Our Fairbanks office is the office where we have staff who have the longest longevity and continue to be, throughout the state, perceived as not having retired on the job, able to significantly participate in program improvements. And so we located the training there to take best advantage of the staff we had available. The training itself will be occurring in Anchorage and Juneau and Ketchikan and around the state in order to reduce the cost.
Well, then, is perhaps the fact that you've got so many that's retired on the job is the reason why you've had to have at least one management consultant come into the Anchorage office to work out problems there?
Sorry, it overstates the case to say we have a problem with people retired on the job in Anchorage. What we've had in Anchorage is an extraordinary turnover. We've had serious management problems throughout the division that I quite honestly think that we inherited that we've been trying systematically to resolve. We think training will be a large measure of the resolution of those problems. We did ask a management consultant to come into the Anchorage office to help improve, suggest ideas of how that things there could be done in a way that would improve the situation. We've aggressively undertaken personnel actions throughout the state, not only in Anchorage, but throughout the state, in order to assure that all staff working for the agency are able to meet high performance standards that we need. We've undergone extensive recruitment activity, a lot of it based on being able to replace the position of social workers in Anchorage. We've had the very high turnover. Some of it as a result of people simply looking around, coming into the office, very competent people coming in, working a few months, looking around at the kind of work, the lack of community support, the relatively low salaries when compared to other comparable positions, even in state government, and deciding that they will just simply not continue to do child protective services and moving on to other agencies. So we have brought in a management consultant there, but that's not the only office we have focused special attention on in our effort to improve the overall system of child protective services delivery in the state. We've also had special reviews in Southeast and in other offices.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, it's no secret to members of this committee the statements that I've made, and I'm going to make it to you so you have a very clear understanding of how I feel. That we spend a tremendous amount of money on health and social services. And it seems to me that every time I turn around, there's another new commission, or there's another new review agency to review different segments, like the new foster panel review board, you name it, the children's youth task force. Seems to me if this department didn't have a tremendous amount of problems, we wouldn't need all these boards, and we wouldn't need all these commissions that we're spending money on. And I, for one, am getting a little sick and tired of hearing all these stories, and we have to create another commission here and another one there and another one there to take care of a problem that with the amount of money that we're spending, it flat should not be there.
Any response? Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, a few questions on the new positions. One, how many of the governor's requested new positions were denied by the budget subcommittee?
Two.
Two positions?
Yes.
And how many were funded?
87.
To ask a few questions about a few on a few pages. I just go to page 35. A project coordinator. What will the project coordinator do?
That's the welfare reforms. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rieger, the project coordinator is for the welfare reform project. We are subject to extensive new federal mandates in this year and the coming year. Implementing the new federal requirements for welfare reform is one of those major requirements that requires five departments to change systems, community and regional affairs because of daycare and job training, labor because of the WIN program, job training issues, revenue, child support, because of child support enforcement division, education, for adult basic education and other factors, and then Department of Health and Social Services as the lead. It's extensive community involvement in design of welfare reform required under the law, as it should be. We want to go even beyond that in the involvement of the community in the welfare reform initiatives in Alaska to ensure that we bring about this best possible program, most appropriate for this state. By hiring the coordinator and the additional staff, which are very specific to the functions which will need to be accomplished in the department, we hope to be able to bring up the system to meet the very short federal deadlines and to ensure we have a good program in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a pharmacist position on page 52 for claims processing. Pharmacist.
That was actually, those were funds appropriated last year, moved by revised program from contractual into a state employment, in state employee, because we were unable to contract for the pharmacist to supervise our pharmacy program.
Further questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On the increment for AIDS, there's about $1 million of federal funds and about $500,000 of state funds. Are those matching state funds, or is that just a supplement to the federal funding?
It's additional money to the federal funds. They do not perform similar services. The state funds are being used for the most basic part of an AIDS response, which is training the staff to do testing and counseling and to basically to prevent the spread of AIDS in that way. The federal funds are for community education and some support activities. There was some subcommittee look at the possibility of shifting those funds, making the state rely on the federal funds. We think that's a very dangerous step to be taken because the federal government is moving toward a formula funding based on population and incidence of AIDS. We're a very low incidence state relative to other states. The incidence is high enough to be concerned about, but we're low compared to other states, and of course our population is small. The estimates are that if the formula is put into place, and there's reason to think it will be, our federal funding could drop from $1 million down to $183,000. So we think it's unwise to rely on the federal funding. We use our state money for our basic testing program and counseling program throughout the state.
Okay. One last one on physicians, Mr. Chairman. I'm just taking it random. Page 83. My antenna always go up when I hear central office because I'm always looking for field people and not home office. Can you tell me what the new positions on page 83 do?
Which? This is a position. Hopefully I'm trying to figure it out. Compared to our other list. These look... I think that these look like the positions created under the funding from the Governor's Interim Commission on Children and Youth in this year that are simply appearing in this budget because they're moved out of the special section that occurred in last year's budget. They're being integrated into the overall budget. And it looks like it's the training, the positions associated with training, and in fact those positions are part of central office, but are actually located in Fairbanks, all but one of them.
Yeah, because there's a footnote. One position was created from the funding in the kitchen, out of eight. The same thing. Yeah, I don't want people to think I'm picking on Juno, but on page 170 on epidemiology, I mean, I hear that there is epidemic problems around the state, and I see all the positions in Anchorage where the home office is. Are those positions also truly statewide positions? They're just listed this way, or are they all in the home office?
Those positions are in Anchorage, but they have a statewide function. That's a relatively small epidemiology staff. They work very closely together. They provide consultation and backup statewide. That's simply where the office is, where they're housed.
It's hard to, on that epidemiology, it looks like FY90 base is 7, FY90 adjusted base is 29. There were some transfers that went on there. You know, it's really hard to pick through these, but I know that I've worked on three subcommittees where we've denied, or the committee has denied, increments for admin generally. And in some cases, I think it was felt that maybe they were justified, maybe they weren't. But I hope it isn't the case that just because this is labeled Health and Social Services, so that there's an idea that this is a high priority, that there's not the same level of scrutiny of the administrative positions. Because I find it hard to contemplate funding 87 out of 89 requested positions here when, you know, 9 out of 10 positions were denied in other budgets. And without having served on it, I can't say that, but I don't know what kind of scrutiny was given, what position by position through 87 of these, but I know in the ones I worked on, we did scrutinize position by position and dropped a lot.
Mr. Chairman, I just might say that we did look at all of the new position requests, and our first level of priority was clearly how they were funded, and then secondarily, whether or not they were required as a result of new federal initiatives or new state initiatives, and in that process, and then third, whether or not we could use them as good farmers in the sense of being able to farm new federal dollars literally by making programs more efficient. And some of these things are literally just processing people who deal with the paperwork back and forth, and without them, you're not as efficient. And we have gained some efficiencies in eligibility determination areas, in claims processing areas, in the Department of Health and Social Services over the last couple of years that I've been chairing the Budget Subcommittee, and I felt that that's a clear area where if you can provide an additional staff effort, and it's picked up by and large 50-50 with the feds, for instance, that you ought to go ahead and take advantage of that, because the efficiencies that are that will accrue to the various functions are worth spending that money, spending money to make money or save money or become more efficient in the whole process. And those are kind of the ways we looked at those new positions.
For example, a document processor is perhaps two new document processors in the area of vital statistics that helped us farm some money.
Well, I think they've been, I think, understaffed there too, our vital statistics area, and we are asking for additional program receipts authority. We are increasing the fees for certificates by $5 a piece in the FY90 budget also. But yes, I would say that we found them a high priority.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other discussion? Are you ready for the question? On the motion by Representative Kopanen that we incorporate the Chairman's recommendations in relation to the HES budget into House Bill 100. Are there any objections to the motion?
Yes.
Any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Schultz?
No.
Representative Swackhammer?
Yes.
Representative Ulmer?
Yes.
Representative Wallace?
Yes.
Representative Barnes?
No.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative Kopanen?
Yes.
Representative Phillips? Representative Rieger?
No.
Co-Chairman Larson?
Yes.
Co-Chairman Hoffman? 7 yeas, 3 nays.
Okay, please note then that the budget has been, the recommendations have been incorporated to House Bill 100. I did remember what I had forgotten, and it has to do not with the agenda today, but it has to do with the agenda on Monday. But on Monday, we're going to hear a presentation on a department that I think in many ways I have to reconsider my earlier support of. But I want to read a quote in the paper. It says, "The proposed reductions could be better understood if it stemmed from a genuine fiscal crisis. But there is no shortage of money in the state." Now, I think whoever made that statement there has his head in the dream world. The statement goes on to state that what we have is a crisis stemming from a lack of leadership, will, and vision. That part I can agree with the individual on. I think we have a lack of leadership from him, a lack of will, and a lack of vision as to what the true condition of the state of Alaska is in. And if this person built his budget on this type of a philosophy, I cannot support it. And I'm talking about Donald O'Dowd, the president of the University of Alaska. And I think we should ask for Mr. O'Dowd's resignation. And if he does not, I think we should demand that the Board of Regents demand it from him. So said. The next budget we have is administration, hopefully on a much happier note.
I'll try to make this a pleasant experience, Mr. Chairman.
Well, by the way, on the resignation, I think we have some concurrence here, at least among both co-chairmen of the House Finance Committee. Representative Ullman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marta is handing out some information that will help us walk our way through this budget. We might just take a moment while Marta does that. There are two documents that are being handed out. One is a very brief memo which describes the functions of the Department of Administration, and the second is an overview of the budget, the increments that we have accepted and the decrements, those increments we did not fund, and some background information provided by some of the agencies within the Department of Administration. By way of an overview, I would like to remind the members of the committee that although the Department of Administration, the title suggests that it has mainly to do with administering state government, over the years, the Department of Administration has become the recipient of a number of programs that don't really fit anyplace else. Of the $197 million of total agency funding, $91 million of that goes to social services, $10 million to the administration of justice, and $94 million to general government. And even within general government, there are a number of things that are not traditionally general government, but come here from other places, whether it's the APOC or the APDC or RATNET. It's kind of a mixture of many different functions. And I just say that by way of introduction because it does put into perspective the variety of things that we're going to have to deal with today in this budget. If you would direct your attention to the Department of Administration FY90 proposal document, which gives you the sort of one-page simple summary, as I did with the court system, you will see that the FY90 governor amended request was $159,272,200. The first item that you deal with is the longevity bonus, and I might just reference for purposes of the record that the longevity bonus was set aside from the subcommittee's deliberations, like several other formula programs have been treated by the committee. That was set aside as something to be discussed and determined by the caucus and not by the subcommittee itself. So the numbers that you see there do not reflect discussions by the subcommittee, but rather discussions and determination by the caucus. For the minority members, I might just try to briefly explain what you see there. The longevity bonus hold harmless of $5,187,000 previously has been in the HES budget, and this document shows a transfer from the HES budget into DOA. The reason this was done was basically to reflect the cost of the longevity bonus program in one place. It was felt that if part of the bonus was in admin and part of the bonus was in HES, that it was never real clear to people when they were looking at the total cost of the program as to what it was. So the policy decision was made to move the hold harmless into the DOA budget. The other policy determination, which has been, at least at this point, approved of by the caucus, is to reduce the longevity bonus total of 56,076 by the hold harmless, and actually also reduce the amount needed for longevity bonus administrative cost increase, which is primarily postage, from the total, and to make the distribution be based on that amount. So, setting aside then longevity bonus and moving on to the other increments, the required additions to the base, EPORS, as you know, is the elected public officer's retirement system. That is not really an option before us. It's statutorily required, and the $76,900 is just the amount based on the number of people who are in the system. The Labor Relations Agency increase for $70,000 is consistent with what we did when House Finance took up the supplemental appropriation. That's the amount of increase in the contractual. Same thing with leases. Leases have been handled by the administration as a formula increase under the theory that they're contractually obligated. And the public advocacy increase of $325,000, which again the subcommittee or the full committee discussed at some length when we added it to the supplemental appropriation. That is not an amount of what I would describe as an option for the agency. Those are as a result of court-ordered appointments representing indigent individuals and children in need of aid, child abuse cases largely. So that gave us a subcommittee base of $102,696,000. The subcommittee recommended several increments and decrements. There is a list of all of those there. We came to a total of a subcommittee recommended of $101,879.8, which was the target budget figure that we received from the Chairman of Finance. The next page is a list of the increments and decrements. The third page in your packet just very briefly shows a comparison in the general government statewide administration costs of between FY83 and FY90. The fourth sheet is a restatement of the proposed reductions that are included in the budget. And then there is some background information from the Public Defenders Agency and from the Division of Client Air Benefits. Now, there are a couple of major policy questions that are in this budget that I'd like to bring to the attention of the full committee. And the first deals with the Pioneers Home. When the budget discussions began and the chairman indicated that we might be looking at some personal services reductions, the subcommittee had discussions with the director of the Pioneers Home in Alaska about how we would actually do some sort of personal services reduction of either 5% or 7.5%. The Pioneers Homes, of course, are 24-hour facilities. The average age of Pioneers Home residents is now at age 82. The individuals in the Pioneers Homes actually, they require a great deal of assistance. And the administrator felt that it would be very, very difficult to reduce personnel, that is to actually lay off people, reduce the level of service in the Pioneers Home. So if we were facing some sort of across-the-board personnel reduction that would actually result in having fewer bodies staffing the 24-hour facilities, we asked the Pioneers Home administrator to let us know what kind of fee increase would be necessary to offset that kind of reduction in personnel, in personal services. And there is a memo basically describing that for the committee. It would present a rather significant increase in fees, and the subcommittee did not feel comfortable recommending that to the full committee at this time. If later in the process it appears that there may have to be some sort of personal services reduction for even 24-hour facilities, I guess we would like to discuss this again with the full committee to perhaps allow them to have increased program receipts authority so that they could increase the fees to offset any reduction in personal services. The other item which we would at least like to put on the table for discussion is proposed intent language for the Pioneers Homes to suggest that they do increase the fees. It has been, I believe, since 1983 since the fees were increased for the Pioneers Homes, and even the Pioneers Homes Advisory Board, when they looked at this issue last year, did suggest that there'd be some sort of fee increase, the caveat being that it not be a dramatic increase and that it happen over a period of time that would allow residents to adjust to it. So that the intent language does not appear in your forms, but I would like to at least share it with the committee and have the committee consider it. I would not recommend the adoption of the intent language at this point in time, but just to have it be something on the table for discussion. The other area of sort of policy discussion, I guess, that I'd like to bring to the committee's attention relates to the RATNET program. We had several subcommittee meetings regarding RATNET. whether or not it should be discontinued altogether, whether or not there were ways that we could either change the programming content or reduce the cost of the RadNet system. And the consensus of the subcommittee was that it was very important to do both, to both reduce the cost of the RadNet system and to shift the programming somewhat from the entertainment to the educational, instructional, and public affairs programming. Also, there will be some proposed intent language for the committee to consider, again, not to adopt today, but just to consider, that suggests that the RadNet board be reduced in its total membership and that it consider a different balance in the programming aspect. The committee, in terms of trying to find a way to reduce the cost of the RadNet system, it was the subcommittee's decision that the purchase of the remaining Earth stations that are currently being leased from Alascom would be a cost-effective move, although it does require a capital appropriation that over time it would result in significant savings to the state of Alaska. As of yesterday, we did receive from Alascom a counter-proposal for the state to consider, instead of purchasing the remaining Earth stations, to change the nature of the lease agreement. That letter has really been received too late for the administration and for the subcommittee to really consider that alternative approach. So at least for purposes of today, we will be remaining with the subcommittee recommendation of reducing the lease costs and purchasing the Earth stations. However, we have asked the Department of Administration to look into it, to discuss it further with Alaskan, and we will be discussing this again. If the subcommittee changes its opinion on it, we will come back to you and make a proposed change. By way of backup at this time, I would like to share with the committee a memo describing the capital request which would be required if we were to purchase the remaining Earth stations, as well as a backup memo from the Department of Administration that itemizes the capital costs that would be required and the reductions in the operating budget which would result. I think we'll probably discuss this again, both in the context of Chairman Hoffman's capital budget process and also perhaps next week after DOA has reviewed Alaskan's proposal. I think those are the two major policy issues that the subcommittee addressed in its deliberations on this budget. Mr. Chairman, the subcommittee would like to move a number of $101,879,000.8.
Okay, we have objections. Okay. Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. One on the Earth stations. I see the footnote says replace them with state-owned equipment. Who will operate these stations once they're replaced and they're state-owned?
The state of Alaska.
So, I haven't had a chance to find the page, but is there an increment for state workers to operate the stations?
Mr. Chairman, the testimony that we received from the Department of Administration was that there would be no additional operating and maintenance costs associated with doing this because their DIVCOM employees already services equipment and is able to absorb this within their budget. I would prefer, however, to request the Department of Administration personnel to come to the table. We have a number of people, Commissioner Anders, Mike Maher, Jim Fox, Sue Plummer, who are far more able to explain to you exactly what kind of servicing is actually done in rural Alaska right now. I might indicate, Representative Rieger, I think there was some skepticism on the part of the subcommittee in terms of the state's ability to absorb that, and that's why the question got asked several times, and the answer was always no additional cost. That is certainly a point which is raised by Alascom in their counterproposal to the state, which we received yesterday, in proposing to reduce the lease costs as an alternative to the purchase of the Earth station. So that's all the information I have available at this time.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, if it's not in the budget, that's satisfactory to me. I think I need this. But I do have a couple of questions on the three questions, I guess, on the three items out of the five required additions to the base. let's just go down. Longevity bonus admin, $46,000. Why is that a required increase?
Mr. Chairman, we took it out again, if you will notice, down below, because it was determined that it would be a, like the whole harmless, a cost that would be assumed within the total longevity bonus payment. I originally put it there because I felt that postage was not an optional expenditure.
Okay. And EPORs, I mean, I see that, but I guess I've never really asked. Why does it keep going up? Because there is EPORS money in the base, I assume. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to rely on the Department of Administration to explain how EPORS is funded. It is my understanding that every year there is an amount with which the legislature has to add to the budget to cover EPORS because it is not actuarially funded in the way in which other state retirement systems are. In other words, there's a general fund draw every single year as opposed to it being something that was accumulated in the employees and employers' account through the years. But I stand to be corrected.
Yeah, maybe we could hear from the department. It's my understanding that general fund pays 100% of the retirement benefits under EPOR.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that. I guess my question is this an increase or is this the whole amount for this agency?
I see.
I can't hear.
And Jim Slocum is also here from Ledge Finance, who perhaps can speak to EPORs as well.
I'm Taylor, Deputy Commissioner of Finance Administration. EPORs was started, I believe, back in 1978, and it lasted 1 year before the voters threw it out.
Sure, I understand the history.
Right.
I'm just
okay. Now you're seeing more and more of those people that qualified for EPORs starting to retire until it starts dropping off.
Okay. So this is an increase.
Mm-hmm. It was 726.2 in 89, and it's 803.1 in 90.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I just have one last question on the required additions. The leases, 874.5 thousand. That one, I remember a question when we first introduced these budgets, we didn't get a clear answer, at least in Anchorage, where lease rates are down. Why are we having this size of an increase in lease costs?
We've been reducing lease rates in Anchorage have been going down over a number of years, and we've been reducing them. We still have expensive leases in Anchorage that are coming due soon, for example, the Frontier Building. In order to move out a very expensive space like Frontier Building, you also have to move the people out to move into like a $1.10 space. So you're not able to reduce all your costs in 1 year. You have to wait until the leases expire. At the same time, the number of square footage has been going up, too.
We are increasing square footage of lease space statewide?
Sure. There is no vacant space in Juneau, Alaska of any significant size.
There's
a lot of different areas, except Anchorage.
Is that because the number of employees is going up?
I mean, all I can tell you is 2 years ago there was lots of vacant space in Juneau. Now there isn't.
So we felt basically.
Well, other peat mining has come in, consumed a lot, et cetera.
It means commercial space.
Oh, not vacant off space leased by us.
And I remember in the boom year of 83, the AID, that is ADA, loans permitted Anchorage to build enough office building to provide a 15% vacancy rate even at that. So I can see why there's a vacant space in Anchorage.
I think if we're trying to reduce the size and scope of state government, this is would be an indicator.
Well,
a lease item would be an
reduce,
indicator.
If you reduce positions across the board, that means I would have available in my leasing budget 100 square feet for position, except you're not eliminating a whole office or anything. And then we have to go through each building and consolidate it, and I might wind up with a couple of extra 1,000 square feet. But I can't cancel a lease without emptying out the floor of the building.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Schultz was next, and I know what he's going to tell us already. He's going to tell us we're fast filling up any empty space.
No, I did have a question on RatNet.
And I'm the wrong person.
Okay. On that program, one of the, I kind of go along with, you know, looking into the acquisition of those things from Alascom. But one of the things I brought up earlier, and I was wondering if I looked into it, because in my opinion, RatNet can be zeroed out, gone, history. It existed from, put a plaque on the wall, you know, whatever, in memorial to that outfit. It's not needed. Every community in my district receives it, okay, off of these satellite dishes that we put in. We simply give the dishes to the communities, and they turn them, and they watch the same programs that we are regurgitating for them. And that's exactly what it amounts to. We beam it back up to, we take this stuff in, ABC, CBS, we're in Alaska, whatever. We take all this stuff in that we make up a program, beam the thing back up, and the people receive it. We have the capability in rural Alaska to receive all of those programs without the state doing it for us. Okay? Why don't we give, and my people that I've contacted in rural Alaska, 90% of them that I've talked to are in favor of that. And they will pay for the maintenance of those things. And it's minimal. Very minimal. So did you look into zeroing them out?
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond to that question. We did. We looked at a number of options. We looked at the possibility of simply saying there will be no more RatNet at all, no more programming. We're not going to lease anymore. If the state owns it, we'll give it to a nonprofit or the municipality or whatever. We're just not going to do it anymore. And I guess there were a couple of concerns which emerged in the discussions we had. Number one, the RatNet system is it's sort of like a communications highway. It is a system of communication which exists and is really the only statewide communication system that goes, you know, from Juneau to Anchorage, from Ketchikan to Kotzebue to Kivalina. I mean, it is a network, setting aside for a moment what we may put on that network, I mean, programming aside, but it is a communication system which, as long as it is linked together, provides this opportunity for us to be able to speak and see each other statewide. I think that has value, and I guess how much value and how much you value that versus other ways that you can spend state dollars, we all have to reach our own conclusions about that. If you allow a nonprofit or a municipality to simply take the ownership of that earth station and point it in whatever direction they choose, in a sense, you've lost that networking capacity. You have to decide who's going to be the license owner, so to speak. The state has some concerns about that. And about the only cost savings to the state is for the, quote-unquote, leases with Alascom for those that we don't own, and for the system that from out of Anchorage kind of beams the programming statewide. And so there are definitely some significant cost savings. But like a lot of other programs, the RatNet program is very, very popular in rural Alaska. It is something that a lot of rural Alaskans have come to rely on as a very important part of, you know, their lives. And taking away a service once it has been offered is very, very difficult, very, very unpopular. And because you have then destroyed this communication network that the state of Alaska has, may not be in the long-term best interests of the people in the state of Alaska.
But absolutely. In my district, you know, it is the most popular. It's the only TV program they receive. Of course it would be the most popular. You know, what I'm saying is give them the Earth Station and allow them to pick up 8 or 9, 10 of them, whatever they want. There is no need for the there is no need for a RatNet. None. Zero. No one can tell me that this program is needed. Even the people in rural Alaska that want RatNet, okay, will tell you if they had their druthers, If they had the ability to take that earth station and turn it and watch whatever program that they would prefer that than what they're getting now. They turn the TV set on, and as your stomach turns, comes on, or whatever, you don't get to watch it because there's another program that they have preempted for you. And so you get Days of Our Lives or whatever. But it is a program, and very seriously, did the committee, okay, and I assume that the people that come before the subcommittee and testified about the elimination of RatNet were people that were working with RatNet, and of course those are the wrong people to talk to if you want to eliminate an entire program. But I really feel that that is an area that needs to be seriously looked at and eliminated. Acquisition on a one-time basis of these earth stations, turning them over and giving them to the communities to maintain. And the maintenance of these things, like we say, is zero. It's nothing. They cost nothing to maintain, hardly anything. In most of the communities, Department of Transportation does it in the normal course of duty. Most of them are located, if you go into the rural areas, you'll find them located very close, and sometimes within the boundaries, the perimeters of a state highway camp, or in my district, a state camp. So, that's it.
Mr. Chairman, I would just say, if the consensus from rural Alaska emerges that the people would really rather have those earth stations and take care of them themselves and receive whatever programming they chose, I, from urban Alaska, wouldn't want to preclude them from doing so. But we didn't hear that. Okay, we didn't hear that from rural Alaska because we were having our meetings.
But maybe
that's true.
If I may follow up, but the reason is because you're talking about taking something away from them, and everyone, the POMs come in, don't take RatNet away. I mean, and I agree, don't take the TV that they are receiving, don't take it away from them. That's not what we're saying. It gives you a better opportunity, not less. You have one program now, and you can pick up 11 or 12 or 15 or 30 or whatever you want to watch. So it enhances their capabilities of watching TV and watching the programs that they want. It does not diminish.
We have Brown, Kopenen, Barnes, Davis, and Schwanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did look at a lot of alternatives, and there were numerous suggestions made, all the way from completely get rid of it to charge a user fee for it, the suggestion about turning it over to the communities. I believe that the most significant problem with that involves the licensing requirements, which somebody else may want to speak to in more detail. But I guess another thing about that is that, or what changed my thinking about it